All right, good afternoon and welcome back. I am Matti Hämäläinen, chairing this afternoon session. And our first speaker is Bob Knight from Department of Psychology at University of California, Berkeley. And his title is Oscillations and Human Prefrontal Cortex.
So I want to thank the organizing committee for inviting me here. I was told by my good friend Earl Miller that he thought he could give my talk because I've been here three times in the last 2 years, but you can't because I tapped 40% of the slides you haven't seen. So I want to see if I can dishabituate your habituated frontal cortex. So, you know, why are we here? I think we're all here because we love science, but I think there's another agenda is we want to understand human disease and normal human behavior so we can help diagnose and treat a disease. So my lab is pretty much focused on studying humans. The talk I'm going to give probably won't have the sequential elegance of some of the talks this morning. It's more a potpourri of some of our findings on oscillations in human prefrontal cortex. Why frontal cortex? Pretty simple. Pretty much, you know, almost every significant neurological disorder, trauma, degenerative diseases, FTD, stroke, tumor, they all can affect the frontal lobe. But you could change this and just call it psychiatric disorders and start talking about lateral frontal cortex and schizophrenia, orbital frontal cortex and OCD and so on. So the frontal cortex is very salient to a wide range of neurological, psychiatric, and developmental disorders. What does the patient look like? Well, if you see somebody who's got a bilateral hippocampal lesion, they're amnestic, obviously, but they walk and talk and can interact quite well in many domains. If you see somebody with bilateral parietal occipital damage, yes, they have visual agnosia, but they walk and talk and can plan and can feed themselves and so on. If you see a patient with a bilateral frontal lesion, lateral frontal lesion, not orbital lesion, they have a profound disintegration in goal-directed behavior. And you're going to just see this patient. He's severely akinetic. He's unable to do any attention, working memory, rule implementation. Pick your frontal task. He can't do it. Okay, don't do it. His frontal release signs, all his grasp reflexes, snout reflex. Sure. He looks severely under-aroused, and that's because his brain, his entire brain is not working, and I'll show you why in a minute.
I'm going to tap you. It's not going to hurt. I'm just going to give you a little tap.
What do you want me to do?
Can you? Okay. I think you can see there's a very
snout reflex. Just really nothing going on with this man. He really is just completely indifferent to his environment. This is the classic Bullock frontal patient.
Open your eyes.
Why is that? If you look at the back of his brain, if you put a lesion in the frontal lobe in a human and you look at the back of the brain, on the side of where the lesion is, the entire back of the brain doesn't work. It doesn't matter what the modality is. The other side works and sometimes even hyperworks and shows evidence of plasticity. And basically, if you think of the patient with the bilateral lesions, there's no hemisphere to take over. Both hemispheres are profoundly under-aroused, probably from loss of long projecting glutamate excitatory pathways, most likely. Again, providing a potential opportunity for intervention in these patients. Now, you know, why oscillations in behavior? I think it's the bridge between human and animal cognition, and I think you're going to find development of treatments based on the work that people in this room are doing, whether it's external stimulation of frequency-specific pathways engaged in behavior, or perhaps using this cortical physiology to develop prosthetic devices. So I think the future is actually quite exciting. Now, what I'm going to show you is just data from electrocorticography, not any of our lesion data. And this is the kind of stuff you see. That's a 1-centimeter grid. These are well put in for intractable epilepsy. And any of the data I show you will be only from good electrode channels, non-epileptic channels. Most, you can see these are 16 patients in the last couple years. You can see you get pretty nice coverage. Obviously, these cases on the bottom are only posterior coverage. And we're going in some places to even higher density grids, 256 channel, 4 millimeter grids. I can tell you we need to get tighter. There is independent information in the cortical, in the electrocorticogram in humans, at least at a millimeter, maybe even at tighter resolution. So right now we're starting to go towards that that level, but we're quite a ways off, because if you replace that grid and made it a 2-millimeter grid, you're going to, you know, quadruple the number of recording channels, which would be great. So let's just look at a couple quick tasks. I'm going to talk to you about first high gamma, this nice brain response, broadband noise, plus minus oscillatory contributions. A simple working memory task, everybody knows it's frontal dependent. Passive task, hear phonemes I, E, A, U. Simple zero back task, whenever you hear U, see a U, press the button. Whenever you hear a U, press the button. And the more difficult two-back task, press the U if and only if it matches the stimulus to stimuli previously. And this looks easy, but it's actually not. Puts a big load on frontal cortex. There's a wealth of single unit and fMRI data. So the first thing is, if we look at this high-frequency band between 60 and 200 hertz, does it track this behavior? Because if it doesn't, we'd have a problem. So here's a pretty simple study. Here's a patient with a grid laid out. This is looking at high gamma from 70 to 160 hertz. There's a quarter millisecond pre-stimulus. This is actually a 2-second movie spread out over 10 seconds. And what you're going to see is they hear the sound, the ooh. In the target, they have to make a decision, and then they press a button. And the whole thing's happened in 500 milliseconds. So let's just stop that at the peak of the frontal lobe activation. And it's about there. Now, if you go to the two-back task, everything in the back of the brain should be pretty much the same. What we should see is a marked increase in different subregions of the frontal lobe, back of the brain, time, etc. And I think you can see, if you just compare those, yes, this high-frequency activity tracks cognitive load, rule implementation, monitoring, and so on. And I could show you lots of other modalities, vision, language, etc., but you'll just have to accept the fact that this high gamma response tracks human cognition. More likely than not, I think it is the driving force behind the bold signal. The other important thing about this high frequency response is that it's reliable at a single trial level, which means you can do the same kind of resampling statistics that you would do in an individual monkey. So here you can see stacked single trials from auditory areas when they heard the phonemes. Here's stacked single trials from middle frontal gyrus as they're implementing the task in the more difficult and the less difficult task. And here's stacked single trials in the motor cortex where there's a really robust signal. And quite a bit of people are interested in using motor high gamma as a method for a motor BMI. So, how reliable is it at the single trial level? Let's just take a look at a very interesting study done by Yadin Flinker as part of his PhD work. And this is Paul Broca. Is Broca's area active during speech? Most people say it is, but there's some question as to whether it really is. So the idea is that you hear things, the Geschwind model, you hear it, it goes to Broca's ear, you pick the motor program, you send it up here, and you basically speak. And it's felt that Broca's area during this entire speech process is active. Now, why may that not be true? This is Broca's first two cases. This is patient Tan. And this is another patient with severe Broca's aphasia, but note there's only a little lesion in the pars opercularis. The Broca's ear is not even taken out. This one, of course, has a very severe, large lesion, but the brain was never cut. And when my friend actually took the brain, Nina Dronkers, and suspended the brain in a magnet, lo and behold, it turns out that, yes, Broca's ear was involved, but so was the arcuate vesiculus and the anterior insula. And if you then look at our patients, and we have a large cohort of patients with Broca's aphasia, the lesion overlap that predicts an inability to speak is not in Broca's area. It's actually subcortically in the insula. So there's a disconnect with the common perception of what Broca's area does. And Dean did a very simple study, did a couple studies. I'll just show you one component of it. You say a word to a person, let's say baseball, and then they have to repeat it, baseball. Of course, you get efferent copy, so when you say it, you actually get less of a response in auditory areas than when you hear it. That's no big deal. But these are the analytic amplitudes, the average across all the single trials over maybe 50 trials. If you look at Broca's area, lo and behold, actually the activity is very quick. It's coming out at 150 to 200 milliseconds, and it's linked to the perception. If you now look at speech onset, Broca's area shuts off, and in fact, the activities in motor and premotor area. This does not fit the classical view of how language is organized, and it's really robust at a single trial level. So here's superior temporal gyrus electrodes. All electrodes in blue are electrodes that are activated when you hear a word. And if you notice, there's massive activation in Broca's area. Superior temporal gyrus, of course, you're driving the system. It lines up beautifully. Here's when you actually speak, the dark line. Broca's area, again, if you notice, is really linked at a single trial basis at about 150 milliseconds post-stimulus to actually the early perception in temporal areas. It shuts off when you actually speak, and in fact, the nearby premotor and motor areas are engaged, not so surprisingly. So this is a nice, you can see how you can use these electrocorticography to actually address very interesting questions in terms of organization of a variety of cognitive operations. Now, some time ago, Ryan Kanulty, who is a grad student at Berkeley, published this paper, which I think confirmed and extended into humans ideas about cross-frequency coupling and notions of Lissman and Buzaki and Pascal, who's here. And this is just from his original paper, where he showed that these are 36,000 single trials across five patients in multiple language and motor tests. And there's the trough of theta, there's the peak, and so on. And that when you look at the high gamma response filtered, this is in the theta band here, 4 to 8 hertz, you can see there's high frequency activity at theta trough. And this was the first report of coupling of cross-frequency coupling in the human cortex in these particular tasks. And we were pretty excited, and the notion was that the degree of coupling and coherence between areas would change as a function of the type of modality you're studying, whether it's language or motor or vision. Subsequently, I think that that has been confirmed by other studies. So this is, again, from the original paper. The degree of coupling centered at theta trough, at the peak at around 130. But notice there's coupling all the way down into lower frequency bands. Some of these frequency bands certainly amenable to actually scalp a recording, and all of them probably amenable to MEG. That's just your 60 hertz line noise. And it's not just because it's a low frequency potential spread all over the cortex. If that was true, you might get more coupling for 1 or 2 hertz. In fact, the degree of coherence in our hands, at least in the task we studies, is really maximum in the theta band. And you can see coherence extends up to 8 centimeters and even longer between cortical electrodes. We've subsequently extended this notion of cross-frequency coupling to motor learning, and this is just one study where people learn a difficult serial reaction time task where different fingers are associated with different numbers. As they begin the task, their performance is not very good. That's motor performance. As they do the task longer and longer and longer, their motor performance gets better and asymptotes eventually. And paralleling their improved motor performance is increasing phase amplitude coupling, which tracks the motor performance, particularly, again, not so surprisingly, in motor and premotor cortices. So I think this and other data, this is very nice work by Fell, Oxmacher, Rudishauer, who've shown the relationship of cross-frequency coupling theta high gamma or theta single unit activity in human hippocampus predicting memory performance. I think the evidence is getting pretty strong that this is an important way for the brain to operate. So in summary, this first part of the talk, you basically get the phase amplitude coupling, frequency for phase, and you get different patterns for motor and different patterns for language. In other words, high coupling between these electrodes involved in superior temporal sulcus, Broca's area, inferior parietal, and in motor tasks, other electrodes. Now, of course, we'd like to know what's going between these electrodes. What's the information being transferred? And I can tell you we don't know what that is. At least I don't. A recent paper points out the power of this kind of frequency coherence between areas. This just came out in Nature Neuroscience, from UC Davis, Arne Ekstrom's lab. A really interesting study where they had patients with ECOG grids in frontal, parietal, and medial temporal sites, and they basically were shown images a grid with stores, and they either had to remember the location of the store or remember when the stores were visited. So they had a spatial trial and a temporal trial. And what they showed, really quite interestingly, is during spatial trials, these areas were phase locked coherence in the 1 to 4 hertz range. The same electrodes, when you switch to the temporal information that was tagged, switched to 7 to 10 hertz. So again, this suggests that even in the same electrodes, you could multiplex your frequency band and have different bands do different tasks. So the potential for this in terms of supporting network dynamics is really quite large. So let me put those together in one study that a postdoc in my lab has just completed. I showed initial parts of this a few months ago, and she's now done. This is called the Starry Night Task. It has a little cueing paradigm, and there's flickering red dots, and every so often, and you're directed to pay attention, in this case to the right field, and press a button when a blue target comes on. The task was actually developed to pick up subtle deficits in stroke patients who had recovered from hemispatial neglect, and it's really quite effective. So here's a trial. That's a target there. Press a button. Here's another trial. You're still cued to the right side. That's an unintended field, so you don't do anything with that, and so on. A really pretty simple task. And she did this data recording in collaboration with a colleague at Stanford, Joseph Parvizi, who runs their epilepsy program, and Nathan Crone, who's at Hopkins, who actually had the first report of high gamma in the human cortex, I think in 1999. So she had 7 patients. Each color is a different patient's grid location. So, you know, there's 4 colors over here and 3 over here, 7 subjects. So she had right and left, had pretty nice coverage to check her notions about what was going on in the classic frontal parietal attention network. Was the frontal parietal attention network being supported by changes in high frequency activity, coherence between brain areas, and increased phase amplitude coupling? So here's the results. So what does this slide show? Here's a left hemisphere grid patient with a couple of electrodes shown here, and we're just showing the degree of high gamma activity. So this would be non-attend. That means they're looking at the screen and the stimuli is coming into the left field and the right hemisphere. So now this hemisphere is not attending to anything. So there's the amount of high gamma. Now they switch and the stimuli now comes into the right field. So that's attended and contralateral to where the grid is, same electrode. Dramatic increase in high gamma. If you now look at phase coherence between electrodes, this is in the 2 to 5 hertz band. It's actually a little bit lower than auditory in this visual task, and I think it's in line with some of the work of Charlie Schroeder's group. This is phase coherence, again, non-attended stimuli. So you're seeing the blue means significant coherence within the parietal cortex. That means if you did the kind of analysis Earl showed on his frontal electrode, there'd be coherence between these electrodes. Red means significant coherence within the frontal cortex. And the blue and red means that they're actually interacting, right? There's some measure of, I shouldn't say they're interacting, there's coherence metric that says they're maybe interacting. So that's the amount of coherence when you're not paying attention. The stimuli is coming into the left field. It's going to your right hemisphere. And here's what happens when you attend. You get a marked increase in the amount of intrafrontal parietal coherence. So if you just look, the thing to see is how many things turn from one color to 2 colors. So here's unattend, and here's unattend. So first, the high gamma goes up. Second, the degree of coupling between these areas goes up. And if we now look at, in these electrodes, the degree of phase amplitude coupling, the low frequency phase and the high gamma response in the non-attended channel, there's coupling in that hemisphere, even when it's not, quote, directly attending. But when you actually have to now attend to something in the right field, you get a marked increase in the degree of coupling. So basically, high gamma goes up, coherence goes up, and cross-frequency coupling goes up. If you switch to the right hemisphere, you see the exact same pattern. Here's a bunch of electrodes that were task active as defined by high gamma activity. And if you looked at degree of phase amplitude coupling from a frontal and a frontal and a parietal electrode, this is when you're not attending. There's activity there. It's not like they're silent, but it goes up dramatically when you actually you're actually paying attention to the field contralateral to the electrode grid. In this case, it would be obviously left field stimuli. And then finally, if you look at the behavioral correlation, you know, we get this physiology as a behavioral correlation. Again, if you look at the reaction time, the reaction time data as a function of the degree of phase amplitude coupling or phase locking coherence, we've done both ways. Basically, if you attend to the contralateral, you see the more phase amplitude coupling you have, the faster you are. And these are just two representative subjects from a right and a left hemisphere case. And if you look at the non-attended field, you don't see that behavioral correlation. So this oscillatory spectrum actually predicts or correlates with behavior. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk to you a little bit about is some more recent work on categorical perception. And we were influenced again by a paper from Earl's lab on the role of frontal cortex and sensory cortices in categorical perception. Before I show you that data, I will show you first some initial work we did on categorical perception with direct intraoperative recordings. The beauty of the intraoperative recordings is that we can put any size electrode we want on the cortex pretty much. So it's a good place to test newer or high density electrodes. Of course, you have to go through, make sure they're standard and approved, etc. So you're actually in the operating room. Okay. The patient's awake because these patients are not epileptic. They're getting tumors removed and we want to map their language. And you can just see the heart pulsing. Yeah. Surgeon's going to put on some electrodes.
You feel some vibrations, Susan.
Epileptic after discharges.
It's normal.
When he's done with the clinical mapping, we then put on a high-density grid.
Do the mapping.
And when you put that high-density grid on, there's all kinds of interesting things you can do. You don't have a lot of time. You only have about 10 to 15 minutes, so it's pretty, I don't want to say tense. It's beyond tense. You just have to not screw up, whatever that is. I don't know what that term actually means. Everything, you want to make sure you're ready to go when the surgeon says go. So what we tested was this idea of categorical perception. The categorical perception is this idea that you chunk things into buckets. You don't have a veridical representation of the world. And it's been known for years that it exists for phonemes, and I think Earl extended into higher cognitive function. So you're going to hear a veridical set of 14 sounds, and it's going to be a ba, da, ga continuum. And most of you will hear this as ba's, and then you'll switch to da, and then you'll switch to ga. You won't hear 14 steps.
La, 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 la.
That's categorical perception. Everybody puts it into three buckets. So question is, how do you do that? You take it all in and sort it, which were like old theories of attention, take it all in, sort it, or do you have an early control system that does this? And the answer in this case was pretty direct with cortical recording. So you could have a veridical representation in the superior temporal gyrus, or you could have a clustered representation. And the bottom line is that there was clearly, you should go to the paper for the methods, they're pretty well documented, clustering algorithms, etc. Basically, the data clustered into three groups, really supporting the fact that by about 110 milliseconds, there was a mechanism that was taking this veridical sound representation and chunking it into three groups. And importantly, as I've seen in some of the prior talks, one electrode could be in more of one representation. So this idea that wasn't like the distribution for ba and then the distribution for ga. They could be interleaved or they could even share a common site. So there's a lot of, I don't want to say redundancy, but a lot of common use. And that's one of the nice things, I think, about the brain. You can use one area for multiple different tasks. So we want to extend this into higher level. So we got the visual stimuli courtesy of Earl's lab, and this is his cat-dog morph, and we came up with an auditory morph because we have a lot of auditory coverage in ECOG, and Matar Haller basically morphed after lots of work and lots of pilot studies, and we morphed a male-to-female voice, or this, I think, is the female-to-male morph, and you'll hear what the patient heard.
Town. 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 Town.
Okay. So we have a visual morph and an auditory morph, and we had two tasks. One where they don't have to do anything other than press a button when something pops out. A strange word in the auditory task where we make one of the animals orange. And then there's an explicit categorization where each stimuli, they have to say dog, cat, male, female. The first thing is we get the behavioral curve you would expect, the categorical perception for both vision morphs and auditory morphs, which I don't show here, but you just heard. Second thing is that we find, even in these high-level stimuli, evidence for categorical perception in both modalities. And I'm just going to, this is not the frontal story, so I'm just going to be very brief, and this is still in process. But you can see here in these superior temporal gyrus electrodes during the auditory task, and this is the explicit categorization, you don't get a smooth transition, even though they are perfectly matched across, you know, it's a smooth auditory transition. You get categorical representation of the male-female, the 60-80 male and the 20-40% female. And in the visual system, you also find evidence of categorical perception, both implicitly and explicitly. I just picked one of each to show you. And that story's still ongoing, and we need to do more work on this. But it's a really rich data set. Now, what I want to show you, though, is the frontal data, because first, we were not able, so far, we haven't found any category-specific frontal electrodes. Now, that is a little different than the single unit data, but you have to remember these grid electrodes are 2.3 millimeter contact. That's a lot of change in the cortex. So there's things right now that, you know, we cannot address. But what we do find is evidence for this integrator idea of decision making, that you accumulate evidence and then you make a decision. It's got a lot of press in Bill Newsom's lab and Shadlin's lab, and most of the data you see is parietal, but we find very strong effects in the frontal lobe. So here's a decision. It was a male or a female voice. It was a cat or it was a dog. And if you note here, what we have are stacked single trial high gamma, okay? And from a frontal electrode, all these electrodes showed the effect, and none of the parietal, by the way. We get an occasional parietal, but most of the activity is frontal. And if you notice, this is your behavioral response, your reaction time. And basically, you have to continue chugging away in your frontal lobe. That trial took a long time to decide. Your frontal lobe worked a lot. You made a quick decision there. Your frontal lobe made a quick decision. And you can see the very strong correlation. When we observed this, we said, uh-oh, we better go back. And we looked at a bunch of other tasks that we have that are not actually published yet, but we specifically went in and looked at the role of frontal lobe in decision making. So self-referential, you hear the word happy, and you have to say, yes or no, I'm happy. Tired, yes or no, I'm happy. An antonym task, which I was happy to actually know finally what that word meant, because I actually don't think I had it in my engineering school. I don't think they ever used that word. The antonym, if you say frown, you say smile, small, big. And then an emotional categorization task, happy, sad. These are really different tasks, but it turns out in every task, if you look at frontal electrodes, the decision time to say yes, to say no, to make the counter, you know, the antonym, et cetera, there's the times, they are all predicted by the high gamma response at a single trial level across all tasks. So I think this is a nice human, I don't know if it's a confirmation or an extension. I should say there's other things in this data set I'm not going into, which is the degree of coherence between these electrodes and auditory electrodes during which goes up, the degree of phase amplitude coupling, which goes up. But I really want to just show this duration effect because it's really pretty much hot off the press, and we're very excited by it. finally, for one more frontal task, this is a task where we're looking to try to get a progressive abstract rule implementation in the frontal lobe. And the task is a little thorny. Basically, there's two simple motor tasks. If either this color or that color box comes up, just press the finger designated by one, the index finger. A little bit more difficult motor task, but not abstract. If the red box comes up, use finger one. If the blue box comes up, use finger two. Pretty straight up. The more difficult part is the more abstract rule implementation task, which has two dimensions. If either of these boxes, color boxes, come up, you're going to get inside them a texture. And you have to decide, does the texture match? So the texture of these two objects is the same. Or you have to decide it's a non-match. You can see this is kind of a rumpled texture. And then in even yet one order higher up, if you get, the red tells you to do a texture, and the blue tells you to do a shape. And a shape, and then you have to make a decision, match, non-match for shape or texture. So even more complex, more rule implementation, more anterior frontal involvement from you would strongly predict. And if you look here, so in the shape match would be, here's two shapes that match, so that would be a one, and here's two shapes that don't match, and that would be a two. So you can see this progressively more difficult pattern of a behavioral response required of the patient. And again, these are GRID patients with extensive ECOG coverage. So here's the subjects, and you can see the premotor electrodes are shown in yellow, and the more frontal posterior, middle, and anterior frontal are shown in blue. You get the expected behavior, the simple blue, press one, you know, et cetera, R1 and R2, very quick, progressively increased reaction times in each subject with the more increasingly abstract rule implementation. So the behavior's nice. Not so surprisingly, if we look at the high gamma response, and we look at the high gamma response locked to the stimulus presentation, basically we get a whole bunch of high gamma activity in motor and premotor cortex for the simple motor task. As we go up the food chain into the more abstract rule implementation, those two-dimensional tasks, and here's the D2 task, the most, you can see that the activity, the high gamma response goes up in the frontal cortex. That's not so surprising. I've actually shown you that working memory, early movie actually shows that. But the interesting thing is actually what's going on in the interregional coherence in the frontal lobe. And this is a little bit like the work that you saw earlier from Earl's lab, but it's not in the beta band. It's actually at a slightly lower frequency band. It's in the theta to low alpha band. And here's what happens. First, you get the degree of theta coherence predicts the reaction time. So in the really simple R1 task, there's a lot of theta coherence and the reaction times are fast. The more difficult the task, basically, your reaction time gets slower. But interestingly, each task has its own preferred phase of coherence in the network that's engaged by that task. So in the R1 task, you can see there's the phase difference between two sets of electrodes in this frontal network. In the R2 task, it actually has a different phase. And in the dimension 1 frontal task, there's the phase. And the dimension 2, there's the phase. So actually, not only can you have multiplexing, you could have within the same network of electrodes, different phase of the same frequency band supporting different cognitive tasks. In this case, progressively more difficulty. And then finally, the degree of phase coherence, this is, I think, really extremely interesting finding. This, by the way, this data is from Brad Wojtek, who is just about to start his first faculty job at UCSD, which we're all very delighted for him. Basically, there's intra-regional phase amplitude coupling. That's one electrode, and the degree of phase amplitude coupling it in the frontal lobe. And then inter-regional, that's how the phase amplitude coupling in this electrode is affected by its coherence with another electrode in the frontal lobe. And as it turns out, if you have if you have theta phase coherence between two frontal electrodes, that predicts whether the electrode, the two electrodes in the pair are going to have phase amplitude coupling. So it's not like they're two separate ones. If you need to have the theta coherence to get the phase amplitude coupling. And this provides a orderly, increasingly complex hierarchy. Here's your D1 to D2, increasing in the frontal lobe potential, increasing hierarchy for information transfer in the frontal lobe as you're implementing progressively more difficult tasks. And a little summary model is, you know, something like this. Here's that D2 task, and there's the phase for the coherence. And the idea is when prefrontal makes a decision and is connected to motor and wants to implement, let's say, the button press response, it's phase coherent. They both have increases in phase amplitude coupling, and the subject correctly performs the task. It's a pretty simple model, and again, this is our first try at this, so we need to do more studies, but it looks to be a pretty reliable finding, and it would explain, it would add to information that oscillatory interactions in the frontal lobe help to enable increasingly more complex cognitive operations. And I should say, if you go back to this, when I saw the two networks that Earl had that were different for, I think, the color versus orientation, you get the same flavor here because the R1 electrodes may be different than the R2, different than the D1. Not only may they be a different collection of electrodes, they may have different, they have different phase relationships between them. So very rich. So finally, just to conclude, because I'm actually on time. To conclude, last time I was here, I showed you this data, which we have a translational component of the lab. Not to say some of this other work may not lead to translational stimulation studies, but this is a pure translational component where we decided to see if we could make some progress in developing a speech prosthesis for people who can't speak, let's say with ALS or with a Broca's aphasia. And there's a lot of people with Broca's aphasia who know what they want to say but can't get it out. So this was data done by Brian Paisley, who just got a K award, which is fantastic. And he basically presented words to patients with high-density grids over auditory regions. Some of this was intraoperative recording, and some of it was the patients with these rarer, very high-density ECOG grids for epilepsy. He records the data. That's the ECOG signal. He comes up with a reconstruction model. I'm not going to go into the details. There's both linear and nonlinear components based on frequency and formant shape of the acoustic waveform. He trains the model. He gets the model to produce a spectrogram. And the spectrogram, you know, of course, you get enough parameters, you can get anything to match anything. So the spectrogram matches the acoustic waveform. That's great. What he did is he kept out half the stimuli. I think the subject's got 100 words, and he used 50 to train the model. And he would present the word to the model. He'd present the ECOG data to the model, and they have to do a binary choice. Was it baseball or football? And 50-50. It should be 50-50. And he got 91% accuracy, which was pretty amazing. And if you look at the reconstructed spectrograms, here's what the person heard. So they heard Waldo. These are just some of the words. Waldo, structure, doubt, property. Here's the reconstructed spectrograms directly from brain recording. And it is, there's an amazing correspondence. And if you basically change your filter bank, and because we had a stop at 7 hertz, you can listen to the reconstructed, you're going to hear what the patient heard and then what was played back from the surface of their brain. And I think you can decide for yourself.
Waldo?
Structure.
Doubt?
Property.
So it's not perfect, but it's getting there. And remember, we have 4-millimeter grids. So we're working very hard on a higher density grid with 256 channels to see if we can improve the reconstruction. Now, this is pretty cool, and it got a lot of attention, but it's doesn't really help the patient other than it was the beginning steps to help a patient. We're just driving their system. And the important step is to get imagination data. Can we get somebody when they imagine a word? Because if we can get somebody who when they imagine a word, then they can speak, right? They could say love, hungry, whatever. At the least, they could do categorical selections between words. We're going not for categorical. We want to reconstruct and actually play back. But we'll see how long this takes. So here's what we use is a ticker tape. And I apologize to the non-Americans. This is a very famous speech.
67 years
We used the ticker tape so we knew when to trigger.
Our fathers.
And here's the person saying it. And here's the patient in another run imagining it as it goes by. So the question is, do these match? And this was our first subject. We thought, ooh, this looks interesting. But it's a tricky world out there because when you're looking for imagined speech, A, you don't know how individual people imagine, right? Do they think of a motor response? Do they think of a sound? Plus, you don't know when they do it, so you got a lot of slop, right? You can move around where you're looking, and then you can delude yourself. You can dynamic time warp, et cetera, et cetera. So we spent the last year working on this, and I'm really happy to say we've got it to work. So here's speech imagination, 7 subjects. These are the electrodes that show the maximal imagination decoding electrodes. Here's reconstruction of overt speech. I've already shown you we could do that, right, compared to random noise. And here's reconstruction of imagined speech. And in each subject, it's significant. It's not at the level that I can play the sound back to you and you would think something's, you could make it out, but it says that the imagined speech spectrogram is closer to the real spectrogram of the word they've heard previously than it is to random noise. So we're pretty excited about this. We think with higher density electrodes and a lot more work, we might actually be able to get this to the next level and produce or at least in collaboration with engineers who would actually produce things. Neuroscientists, I don't think we produce anything, do we, other than papers? We would produce a prosthetic device that could be helpful. So in closing, you know, Matar did the categorical perception work, and Stephanie Martin is an engineering student who did the speech imagination work. Sarah did that visual data I showed you. Ryan described cross-frequency coupling. Adine did the Broca's work. Brian is really the guy in charge of this speech reconstruction program. Now that he has his K, he will be totally in charge. And these are some of the great collaborators that I've had. In particular, Yosef Parvizi at Stanford, who's an epileptologist, Nathan Krohn at Hopkins, who's an epileptologist, and Eddie Chang, who's a neurosurgeon at UCSF. And the nice thing about them is that they are all really cognitive neuroscientists. So they want to understand the brain, so they're really tremendous to work with. They understand what we're all trying to accomplish. So with that, I will stop and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this exciting presentation. Now, time for questions.
Who wants to be implanted? What's... Please.
You talked a lot about the high gamma activity. Yeah. I wonder, do you have any speculation of what the mechanisms of that are? Is it higher than you think? Is it?
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is you don't see it as much in the, if you look at all the monkey papers, you don't see it at that high. At least I haven't seen it. I mean, I think the party line now is it's kind of broadband spike cache and or oscillations from fast recurrent inhibitory neurons. I think the party's out on what the actual cause is. I think that's where interaction with my colleagues in physiology are going to be very critical. I can tell you this, it's ubiquitous in the cortex. Everybody has it. I guarantee everybody who if you all raise your right hand, your left motor cortex gets high gamma. It's just the way it is. I mean, it's pretty much everywhere. It's an orphan potential. It needs help.
Thank you. In the
speech,
yes. If we have a microphone.
Let me say it again. Bravo. It's just so beautiful. A quick question. In the imagined speech case, do you have EMGs, or are they moving anything, do you think, or is this pure cognitive activity?
It's pure cognitive. We have two other experiments that we've done where they have them press and release a button as they're imagining.
Fantastic.
But you don't get any muscle activity. It's a really tough, I mean, the inter-op stuff is brutal to do. So what we really need are higher density grids and the more chronic implantations. I have a kind of a funny story. When we first published that paper last year on the speech reconstruction, we were getting interviewed by all kinds of people. Everybody was interested in the medical potential applications, but they also worried about the evil implications. How is a great brother going to use it for some horrible thing? And after about 4 days, Brian and I were feeling, well, you were getting burned out. And I got interviewed by a really smart live radio announcer in Johannesburg, and she was great. She asked all the proper questions, and at the end she said, hey, it's really, they're repressive to the press here. Could this be used? And I would give my standard response, you know, well, you need surgery, it's above my pay grade, my ethics with the patient. And finally I lost it and I said, do you do bridal showers in South Africa? And she said, we always do things for the ladies. I said, how about we bring the guy in, we implant them, and the bride and her girlfriends can interrogate him before the wedding. And she said, well, that's the greatest idea. So there you go. It could be used for all kinds of evil things. Science gone amok.
One of the technical problems is what happens in the sulci, which must, and I was wondering, do you have any ideas of how to overcome that limitation?
Yeah, I think the way to, well, number one, I think the only way to overcome the ECOG method is to have higher density grids where you try to do source localization of depth sources, but we don't have a tight enough distribution. You know, if we had a distribution of 1 centimeter spaced electrodes, you might be able to do source localization down 3 or 4 millimeters into the sulci. We'll never get, I shouldn't say never. I mean, that's a bad thing for me to say since I started my neurology residency without a CT scan, so there have been a few developments in the last 30 years. But it is relatively silent area. And you can't slide into the sulci. As a neurosurgeon, if you break the pia arachnoid, your risk of infection is going through the ceiling. I talked to them quite a bit about, you know, would it be safer to do epidural chronic recording? I should say our colleagues in engineering are working on a 256-channel wireless externally chargeable device. And we want to know, should we put it in epidural or subdural? And the neurosurgeon said subdural is better, that epidural can be really nasty surgery because you have to pull the dura away from the bone. So we'll see. I mean, I think if we have these in patients, these are all acute experiments. If we had someone who really was committed to being trained, I think we could do. So I know we could do categories. We could have a select between 5 or 6 words. But it'd be really nice if we could actually reconstruct their. I don't want to say thought because then you sound creepy. There are words that you want to say.
Wouldn't you be able to see in the sulci if the gyri wouldn't be active at all? I mean,
you get something, and that's where if you had a high density grid, you may be able to do, you know, source localization locally. I mean, that was what I was like.
But you are overwhelmed basically by the gyri.
I'm sorry.
You are overwhelmed by the gyri. So
there's a lot of signal. I mean, these signals are huge in the, particularly in primary auditory, visual, somatosensory, motor, they're huge signals. So they're quite, I mean, the nice thing about the high frequency response is when you're on the surface of the brain, there's no noise in that frequency band. Other than you get occasional machine noise, but we can get rid of that. That's usually something that we get in the ICU setting. But the signal's only about 10 microvolts. But there's nothing else in that band. I mean, the problem is for the EEG, and we saw some EEG data that gets around partially, is, you know, by the time you get to the scalp, that 10 microvolts is, you know, 1 microvolt, and it's in noise. But maybe someone will figure it out.
But the same applies, of course, and for EEG and EEG, that frequency range, you don't have anything else.
Yeah, no, it's a wild rep, right? It's pretty simple. It's a wild rep power law. I mean, the higher frequencies, which have the most information, unfortunately, are the small sample.